Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining me today. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, it's one of the first pieces put on public display by a pope, a prestigious Vatican exhibit on the Laocoon, the famed classical sculpture that has inspired artists for centuries. One of Rome's oldest shrines dedicated to the church's first martyr reopens after lengthy restoration. Who was this first century saint, and how did his cult spread to imperial Rome? It was a chilly January day in 1506 when a farmer working out in his vineyard near the Roman Colosseum fell down into a cavernous hole. What he found buried there turned out to be one of the most treasured masterpieces in the entire history of the world's art, the Laocoon, and for nearly half a millennium it has belonged to the Vatican Museums.
A certain Felice de Fredis went out to his garden on that day in 1506 and fell into a hole. And when he looked up, he saw the Laocoon.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath is a chief curator at the Vatican Museums. He says what Felice saw was an almost life-sized ancient sculptural group of a father and his sons trying to free themselves from deadly snakes. The farmer fell into the hole on the Opio Hill, or Colle Opio, a 350-acre area which once bore the luxurious palaces, villas, and pavilions of ancient Rome, many built by the Emperor Nero before his death in 68 AD.
In antiquity, there was just the Golden House of Nero. So it is an area which has no geology. It's all foundations and holes and whatnot. That's where they sheltered the Laocoon from the barbarians when they conquered Rome. That's where it was forgotten, and that's where this man fell into a hole on the 14th of January.
Subito tutti i cittadini, tutte le persone di una certa cultura si recarono sul posto. Le cronache del tempo dicevano pare un giubileo, tutti i cardinali soiti a vedere proprio in
The director of the Vatican Museums, Francesco Buranelli, says the momentous discovery caused such a stir that Pope Julius II soon heard of it and sent two of his most trusted artists to examine the sculpture. The architect Giuliano di San Gallo and Michelangelo, who just happened to be having tea together that day.
He sent his architect Giuliano di San Gallo when he heard from the rumors that something important had happened downtown. And Giuliano di San Gallo had Michelangelo for tea or something, so he asked him to come along. They both got on their horse with the little son of Giuliano's sitting behind, and he, about 60 years later, describes that whole story, how they go to the Colle Opio and how they look down into that hole, and then he claims that his father said the famous sentence, "This is the Laocoon," which Pliny describes.
Pliny was the first century Roman historian who first wrote of the existence of a marvelous work of sculpture depicting a writhing Laocoon and his sons in the grips of sea serpents. It was a composition he called superior to any painting and any bronze, carved from a single block by eminent Greek craftsmen. But for centuries, all trace of this incredibly intricate statue was lost, that is, until January 14th, 1506. Soon after its discovery, Pope Julius acquired the Laocoon, which, along with a collection of other sculptures, formed the beginning of the Vatican Museums. In fact, Julius began a five-century-long tradition. The popes were among the first sovereigns who opened their art collections of their palaces to the public, promoting knowledge of art history and culture. But where does the Laocoon image and the story come from? Some decades before Christ was born, the Latin poet and philosopher Virgil wrote about the Laocoon, a Trojan priest, in his 12-book epic poem, The Aeneid. In it, he tells the story of the Trojan horse, constructed by Greek soldiers to trick the city of Troy into letting them sneak within its walls for a crippling attack.
The sides were planked with pine. They feigned it made for their return, and this the vow they paid. Thus they pretend. But in the hollow side, selected numbers of their soldiers hide. With inward arms the dire machine they load, and iron bowels stuff the dark abode.
But Laocoon was wise to their wicked plan and rushed to warn his fellow citizens.
Laocoon, followed by a numerous crowd, ran from the fort and cried from far aloud, "O wretched countrymen, what fury reigns? What more than madness has possessed your brains? Think you the Grecians from your coasts are gone? And are Ulysses' arts no better known? This hollow fabric either must enclose within its blind recess our secret foes, or 'tis an engine raised above the town to o'erlook the walls and then to batter down. Somewhat is sure design, by fraud or force. Trust not their presence, nor admit the horse."
To prove his point, Laocoon thrusts his spear into the belly of the horse, but still the people of Troy do not believe the danger that awaits them. Then a horrifying scene unfolds, which the people of Troy take to be divine and terrible punishment meted out to Laocoon for defying the gods.
Laocoon, Neptune's priest by lot that year, with solemn pomp then sacrificed a steer. When dreadful to behold, from sea we spied two serpents, ranked abreast, the seas divide, and smoothly sweep along the swelling tide. Their flaming crests above the waves they show, their bellies seem to burn the seas below, their speckled tails advance to steer their course, and on the sounding shore the flying billows force. And now the strand, and now the plain they held, their ardent eyes with bloody streaks were filled, their nimble tongues they brandished as they came, and licked their hissing jaws that sputtered flame. We fled amazed, their destined way they take, and to Laocoon and his children make, and first around the tender boys they wind, then with their sharpened fangs their limbs and bodies grind. The wretched father, running to their aid with pious haste, but vain, they next invade. Twice round his waist their winding volumes rolled, and twice about his gasping throat they fold. The priest, thus doubly choked, their crests divide, and towering o'er his head in triumph ride. With both his hands he labors at the knots, his holy fillets the blue venom blots. His roaring fills the flitting air around. Thus, when an ox receives a glancing wound, he breaks the bands, the fatal altar flies, and with loud bellowings breaks the yielding skies. Their tasks performed, the serpents quit their prey, and to the Tower of Pallas make their way.
With Laocoon's horrific demise, the rest, of course, is history. the people of Troy accept their gift horse, bringing it and their own doom into their city gates. And while it does capture the sweeping drama, the Vatican's Laocoon statue may not be a faithful depiction of Virgil's epic story. In fact, it may give room for hope that at least one of the unlucky threesome survives.
There are in antiquity, of course, various versions of the story. One version actually says that not all three were killed, but that one of the sons, the elder son, escaped, and maybe the statue in the Vatican is not based on Virgil's version of the story, but on the version that describes how the elder son, who is not sitting on the altar, who is only entwined in one or two parts of the snake, and he may actually get away, and it may be precisely that story.
The boy, in fact, looks indeed like he may soon free himself from the snake looped around his foot and shoulder. But whichever legend inspired its artists, the Laocoon in the Vatican soon became an icon for artists, writers, and poets, who, from the 16th century on, have come to see it and draw upon its swirling, contorted forms and vivid expressions of fear, grief, and pain for inspiration.
Once you're in front of what's considered already by the ancients as the greatest work of art, as an artist, and also as anybody in the art world, that is a great challenge. And that is what these artists felt, what stimulated them, and what then also stimulated artistic theory. People like Winckelmann, Lessing, Goethe, they all wrote about the statue. Writers like Charles Dickens quoted him. So
William Blake.
Almost every artist had some kind of a reaction, positive or even negative, to the Laocoon. If you think of El Greco, he quite explicitly wanted to invent a picture which showed that he knew the Laocoon but was doing something creative himself.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath, curator at the Vatican Museums. We also heard from the director of the Vatican Museums, Francesco Buranelli. The Laocoon exhibit in the Vatican Museums contains more than 100 works of art, many on loan from some of the world's most prestigious museums, including the Metropolitan in New York, the Louvre, and the Hermitage, among others.
It's a unique opportunity to juxtapose the Laocoon with Primaticcio's replica from Fontainebleau. We've been able to get a statue of the same theme, which was done before the Laocoon was discovered, from Dresden in Germany by Francesco Di Giorgio Martini, one of the greatest 15th century artists. We have the little plaque by Moderno from Vienna, which is one of the first adaptations of the Laocoon, where a Christ in a flagellation is modeled on the pose of the Laocoon. So these are the wonderful pieces that we have in the exhibition around the original statue and that in some way are related to it. Of course, we have the great names here. We have a drawing by Raphael, we have drawings by Rubens, we have a drawing by Bernini.
Didn't I also see a bust, a marble bust?
By Bernini, attributed to him. We have a model by Osip Zadkin for the monument for the destruction of Rotterdam. So down to the contemporary art, we have reactions to the Laocoon in this exhibition.
It includes bronze casts, copies and models based on the Laocoon, manuscripts, prints, paintings, and exquisite porcelain sculptures. But you'll have to hurry to see it. The exhibit is being held for a limited time only through February 28th. Not much is known about him, except that he was one of the newborn Christian church's first deacons, called by Jesus' first apostles to help spread the good news. Saint Stephen was also the church's first martyr, stoned to death some 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem, for his belief that the Messiah had died so that we might live. Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev told me what is known about the life of St. Stephen and how his cult flourished in the early church, so much so that the Roman Emperor Constantine even built a church to him here in Rome. Today, his feast is celebrated by the church on December 26th each year.
His story comes up after the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles as one of the first deacons. If you remember, the apostles ordained seven deacons in order to assist them in the functions of the church, and Saint Stephen is the most famous one. And shortly thereafter, the preaching and the teaching and the example of Saint Stephen outrages the members of the local community to the point where Saint Stephen was famously stoned.
And this all occurred just outside of Jerusalem, didn't it?
It all occurred outside of Jerusalem. The story of the martyrdom is extremely interesting because it brings us into another, it introduces us to another very, very important character of the New Testament. The martyrdom of St. Stephen was very impromptu. St. Stephen raged the elders and they gnashed their teeth and they dragged him outside the city walls of Jerusalem and they began to throw stones to stone him, but they were wearing heavy cloaks, and their cloaks got in the way of throwing stones. So they took them all, and they gave them to a man in the crowd whose name was Saul of Tarsus. And Saul of Tarsus was kind of like the coat check guy for the stoning of St. Stephen. And after the stoning, Saul of Tarsus thought that these Christians were a very pernicious force. He himself would go to Damascus and would gather more Christians, arrest more Christians. And on the road to Damascus, he was visited by Christ, and he converted and became Saint Paul. So not only do we have the first follower to make the transition from this world to heaven, the first great example of following in the footsteps of Christ by dying for Christ, but at the same time, we have the rebirth of another man that goes from this story, the death of Saul and the rise of Paul.
So this would have all happened within a few decades after the death of Jesus Christ.
Yes, even sooner, within a decade. It was immediate.
Mm-hmm. Where in Rome is there a church dedicated to St. Stephen? I know there is a very famous one.
The deacons in Rome are both very honored. There are two deacons honored in Rome. There's St. Lawrence and St. Stephen, and their churches are built immediately, along with the apostles, along with Christ the Savior. But churches to the two famous deacons, Lawrence martyred in Rome and Stephen martyred in Jerusalem, are built immediately by Constantine, 4th century, or in the Constantinian age. St. Stephen's church, the Caelian Hill, has apparently, from recent archaeological excavations, foundations that go back to the 4th century in the time of Constantine, although the church itself is documented from the 5th century on.
But was St. Stephen actually ever physically here in Rome?
No, St. Stephen never came to Rome, of course. His life, his short life, blossomed, flowered, and ended in Jerusalem. But it's the pairing of the two deacons, the two martyrs, because St. Lawrence was martyred as a deacon of Sixtus I. And so this famous martyrdom of a deacon in Rome and the famous martyrdom of a deacon in Jerusalem, bringing the two together makes that uniting of Rome and Jerusalem even stronger. So eventually, in the 6th century, the body of St. Stephen was brought, or a relic of St. Stephen is probably more likely, was brought from Jerusalem to Rome. And so there was, in the sanctuary of Santo Stefano Rotondo, this round church to St. Stephen on the Caelian Hill, a remnant of the great martyr.
Now, of course, in pagan times, the round temple was a very common form of architecture, wasn't it? So why was a church made in a round form?
That's a really interesting point about this church. This church is fascinating to archaeologists and art historians because it draws deliberately on the pagan tradition of a round temple. The pagans generally used round temples as victory temples. You would construct them in the wake of a great battle. You'd construct them dedicating it to the god who helped you in the military victory. And the Christians adapted this particular shape of a temple. In this case, in one case only in Rome, for St. Stephen's Temple on the Caelian Hill, building it in the round circular form to mirror the idea of an ancient Roman victory temple, but also to mirror the first round temple, the first round church to be built in Christendom, which of course is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built by Constantine in Jerusalem on the site of the tomb of Christ.
And of course, it would also mirror the Pantheon.
It does mirror the Pantheon as well. The Pantheon is an extremely complex building, and it's a building that was admired immediately it is admired already as the great showpiece of the Roman civilization, and the Christians experiment a great deal with the Pantheon. And of course, the Pantheon was the very first Roman temple to be converted into a church.
Now, let's talk about Santo Stefano Rotondo, St. Stephen the Round Church. What makes it also very interesting is the fact that it has a colonnade, a circular colonnade in the center of the space. Why is that?
It was actually originally supposed to have three concentric colonnades. It's supposed to have three sets of colonnades, which again, from 4th century building and even earlier, we have an example here in Rome, the Temple of Hercules Victor by the Tiber River. It's customary when constructing the victory type temple to have a colonnade that surrounds on the outside. Roman pagan temples put their columns on the outside. But since fundamentally Christians are turning these pagan churches inside out, the three sets of concentric columns in St. Stephen's, one of the sets is lost, creates a sense of closing in towards a core in the center. And in the center, you have the relic, or you know, what should have been the body of Stephen, but in this case, a relic.
Why do you think that this particular form of church was chosen to, I don't want to say represent, but to honor or as a place of worship for St. Stephen? I mean, there must have been other forms of architecture that were known at the time, available at the time. St. Peter's Basilica was beginning to be
constructed.
Yes.
In the history of Christian art, when we look at images of the martyrs, we see crowns and palms, and those are always symbols of victory. And so to emphasize, especially in this early period after the martyrdoms, Christianity, when St. Stephen's was built, Christianity had been a legal religion or the sole religion of the empire for only a century or so. And so to remind people of the victors who made the religion legal, they emphasize the idea of triumph, the idea of having won a tremendous battle. And so St. Stephen, who has the post of the special place in the calendar of being the day after the birth of Christ, comes the first man to emulate Christ's self-sacrifice. And if you remember the beautiful self-sacrifice of Stephen, because Stephen, as his executioners are throwing stones at him, he begs Christ to forgive them. And so in this, you see that true sense of Christian victory. And so by taking the first martyr and by building him a church which is specifically connected with the idea of victory, the Christians created an imagery, an architectural form that explained what martyrdom is. It's not the death, it's not the end, it's the beginning. And to just bring back the question of Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem had already been constructed by Constantine. So already in early 4th century, the Christians had already begun an architectural representation of Jesus's, the site of Jesus's burial and resurrection, as a triumphant area.
Visitors to this church up on the Celio Hill, what would they see? Were there particular frescoes on the walls, statues, anything that would stand out?
Oh, the church definitely stands out. It's quite a church. From its 5th century construction, it was very beautifully decorated with the columns of the colonnade, our fabulous marbles. In the 12th century, they put in a Cosmatesque floor, which you can still see remnants. But the interesting part of this church takes place in the 1580s, which is post-Council of Trent, this new counter-reformation spirit, and the church was handed over to the Jesuits. And the Jesuits put in the church under this period, a whole cycle of frescoes was painted along the interior wall, and they all show martyrdoms, something like 30-odd martyrdoms that are very, very graphic. It's almost as if it's the Mel Gibson of the mid-16th century with all of the kind of clever ways of decapitating, burning, skinning alive, and perhaps not for the squeamish, some of them. Around the remnant of the first martyr, to have all these other examples of other men and women who died so that Christianity could spread in the world, it became a place for the young Jesuit novitiates who were going to become missionaries and who were sent out in the world to face probably this kind of death, to go and meditate what it takes to evangelize. There's also a mosaic of Christ between two martyrs, of which one is probably St. Stephen. St. Stephen's martyrdom shows up in many different churches in Rome. There are a few churches dedicated here and there to St. Stephen. They're smaller churches. Nothing quite compares to this extraordinary, unique architectural manifestation for St. Stephen. But there's a church near the Pantheon dedicated to St. Stephen. There are several. And if you look in a great many churches, there are chapels dedicated to St. Stephen. So you'll walk into one church, you'll walk along the chapels, and there'll be St. Stephen. Again, particularly reprised in the 16th and the 17th century, when martyrdom becomes on the forefront of everyone's mind. After the Reformation, during the 30 Years' War, it's very, very common to start showing martyrdom scenes again. And of course, over at the Church of St. Lawrence, the Basilica of St. Lawrence outside the walls, Stephen is naturally represented because a very old legend, the Golden Legend by Jacopo da Voragine, the volume of the stories of the saints written by a Catholic bishop in the 13th century, and he tells these wonderful stories of all the martyrdoms, of all the saints. And specifically, St. Stephen's legend ends with the body of St. Stephen being transported from Jerusalem to Rome, and wondering where to put it, they think to put it in the tomb of St. Lawrence. And so they go to the Church of St. Lawrence, and they opened the tomb of St. Lawrence, and there was the body of St. Lawrence, who rolled over to make a little room for Stephen, which I think is one of the most lovely stories of the Golden Legend.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.